The princess's hair began by being a yard long, and it grew an inch every night.
This week on Selected Shorts, Big Hair and Life is Short.
Grace considers it a freak accident that anyone ever makes it through life in one piece.
I'm John Lithgow, and you're listening to Selected Shorts from PRI, the program that brings you great short fiction, classic and contemporary, read live on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. This program is devoted to wondrous women in two stories that happen to be read by two wondrous women friends of mine, Jane Curtin and Jill Eikenberry. First, Jane reads Melisande. With us in the studio is Selected Shorts literary commentator, Hannah Tinti. Hello, Hannah.
Hello, John.
Welcome aboard. What can you tell us about the author of this story, E. Nesbitt?
E. Nesbitt was the pen name of Edith Nesbitt, who was born in England in 1858 and published over 60 books. She's often compared with Lewis Carroll, and her tales of adventure and fantasy have influenced many writers, from C.S. Lewis to J.K. Rowling. John, you've written a number of books for children. What were your favorite books growing up?
You've named several English writers, and I think English writers were among my favorites. Mm-hmm. A.A. Milne, Beatrix Potter. I always loved the way they wrote for kids as if they were writing for adults.
And this is what Nesbitt is playing at with Melisande when she takes this classic fairy tale of Rapunzel and gives it a modern, fresh, and even slightly feminist twist.
Yes, and they found the perfect reader for this story, that great actress and great comedian, Jane Curtin, reading E. Nesbitt's Melisande. Let's listen.
When the princess Melisande was born, her mother, the queen, wished to have a christening party, but the king put his foot down and said he would not have it. "I've seen too much trouble come of christening parties," said he. "However carefully you keep your visiting book, some fairy or other is sure to get left out. And you know what that leads to. Why, even in my own family, the most shocking things have occurred. The fairy Malevola was not asked to my great-grandmother's christening, and you know all about the spindle and the 100 years' sleep." "Oh, perhaps you're right," said the queen. "My own cousin by marriage forgot a stuffy old fairy when she sent out her cards for her daughter's christening, and the old wretch turned up at the last moment. The girl drops toads out of her mouth to this day."
"Exactly. And then there was that business of the mouse and the kitchen maid," said the king. "We'll have no nonsense about it. I'll be her godfather, and you shall be her godmother, and we won't ask a single fairy. Then none of them can be offended."
"Unless they all are," said the queen. And that was exactly what happened. When the king and the queen and the baby got back from the christening, the parlor maid met them at the door and said,
"Please, Your Majesty, several ladies have called. I told them you were not at home, but they all said they'd wait."
"Are they in the parlor?" said the queen.
"I've shown them into the throne room, Your Majesty," said the parlor maid. "You see, there are several of them."
There were, in fact, 700. The great throne room was crammed with fairies of all ages and all degrees of beauty and ugliness, good fairies and bad fairies, flower fairies and moon fairies, fairies like spiders and fairies like butterflies. As the queen opened the door and began to say how sorry she was to have kept them waiting, they all cried with one voice, "Why didn't you ask me to your christening party?"
"I haven't had a party," said the queen.
She turned to the king and whispered, "I told you so." This was her only consolation. "You've had a christening," said the fairies all together.
"I'm very sorry," began the poor queen.
But Malevola pushed forward and said, "Hold your tongue," most rudely. Malevola is the oldest as well as the most wicked of the fairies. She is deservedly unpopular and has been left out of more christening parties than all the rest of the fairies put together.
"Don't make excuses," she said, shaking her finger at the queen. "That only makes your conduct worse. You know well enough what happens if a fairy is left out of a christening party. We are all going to give our christening presents now. As the fairy of the highest social position, I shall begin. The princess shall be bald. The queen nearly fainted as Malevola drew back. Another fairy in a stylish hat with snakes on it stepped forward with a rustle of bat's wings. But the king stepped forward, too. No, you don't, said he. I wonder at you ladies. I do indeed. How can you be so unfairy-like? Have none of you been to school? Have none of you studied the history of your own race? Surely you don't need a poor, ignorant king like me to tell you this is no go. How dare you, cried the fairy in the hat, and the snakes quivered as she tossed her head. It is my turn, and I say the princess shall be. The king actually put his hand over her mouth. Look here, he said, I won't have it. Listen to reason, or you'll be sorry afterward. A fairy who breaks the traditions of fairy history goes out, you know she does, like the flame of a candle. And all tradition shows that only one bad fairy is ever forgotten at a christening party, and the good ones are always invited. So either this is not a christening party, or else you were all invited except one. And, by her own showing, that was Malevola. It nearly always is. Do I make myself clear? Several of the higher-ranking fairies who had been influenced by Malevola murmured that there was something in what His Majesty had said. Try it if you don't believe me, said the king. Give your nasty gifts to my innocent child. But as sure as you do, out you go, like a candle flame. Now then, will you risk it? No one answered. And presently several fairies came up to the queen and said what a pleasant party it had been, but they really must be going. This example decided the rest. One by one, all the fairies said goodbye and thanked the queen for the delightful afternoon they had spent with her. It's been quite too lovely, said the lady with the snake hat. Do ask us again soon, dear queen. I shall be so longing to see you again, and the dear baby. And off she went, with the snake trimming, quivering more wildly than ever. When the very last fairy had gone, the queen ran to look at the baby. She tore off its lace cap and burst into tears, for all the baby's downy golden hair came off with the cap, and the Princess Melisande was bald as an egg. Oh, don't cry, my love, said the king. I have a wish lying around that I've never had occasion to use. My fairy godmother gave it to me for a wedding present, but since then I've had nothing to wish for. Thank you, dear, said the queen, smiling through her tears. I'll keep the wish till baby grows up, the king went on. And then I'll give it to her, and if she wants to wish for hair, she can. Oh, won't you wish for it now? Said the queen, dropping tears and kisses on the baby's round, smooth head. No, dearest. She may want something else even more when she grows up. And besides, her hair may grow by itself. But it never did. Princess Melisande grew up as beautiful as the sun and as good as gold. But never a hair grew on that little head of hers. The queen sewed her little caps of green silk, and the princess's pink and white face looked out of them like a flower peeping out of its bud. And every day as she grew older, she grew dearer, and as she grew dearer, she grew better. And as she grew more good, she grew more beautiful. Now, when she had grown up, the queen said to the king, My love, our dear daughter is old enough to know what she wants. Let her have the wish. So the king wrote to his fairy godmother and sent the letter by a butterfly. He asked if he might hand on to his daughter the wish the fairy had given him for a wedding present. I've never had occasion to use it, said he, though it has always made me happy to remember that I had such a thing in the house. The wish is as good as new, and my daughter is now of an age to appreciate so valuable a present. To which the fairy replied by return of butterfly, "Dear king, pray do whatever you like with my poor little present. I had quite forgotten it, but I am pleased to think that you have treasured my humble keepsake all these years. Your affectionate godmother, Fortuna F." So the king unlocked his gold safe with the 7 diamond-handled keys that hung at his girdle, took out the wish, and gave it to his daughter. And Melisande said, "Oh, father, I wish that all your subjects should be quite happy." But they were that already, because the king and queen were so good, so the wish did not work. So then she said, "Then I wish them all to be good." But they were that already because they were happy. So again, the wish fell flat. Then the queen said, "Dearest, for my sake, wish what I tell you to." "Oh, why, of course I will," said Melisande. The queen whispered in her ear, and Melisande nodded. Then she said, "I wish I had golden hair a yard long, and that it would grow an inch every day and grow twice as fast every time it was cut, and..." "Stop!" cried the king. And the wish worked. For the next moment, the princess stood smiling at him through a shower of golden hair. "Oh, how lovely," said the queen. "What a pity you interrupted her, dear. She hadn't finished." "What was the end?" said the king.
"Oh," said Melisande, "I was only going to say, and twice as thick."
"It's a very good thing you didn't," said the king. "You've done about enough." For he had a mathematical mind and could do the sums about the grains of wheat on the chessboard and the nails in the horse's shoes in his royal head without any trouble at all.
"Why? What's the matter?" asked the queen.
"You'll know soon enough," said the king. "Come, let's be happy while we may. Give me a kiss, little Melisande, and then go to nurse and ask her to teach you how to comb your hair."
"I know how," said Melisande. "I've often combed mother's."
"Your mother has beautiful hair," said the king, "but I fancy you will find your own less easy to manage." And indeed it was so. The princess's hair began by being a yard long, and it grew an inch every night. If you know anything at all about even the simplest sums, you will see that in about 5 weeks, her hair was about 2 yards long. This is a very inconvenient length. It trails on the floor and sweeps up all the dust, and though in palaces, of course, it's all gold dust, still it's not nice to have it in your hair. And the princess's hair was growing an inch every night. When it was 3 yards long, the princess could not bear it any longer. It was so heavy and so hot. So she borrowed nurse's scissors and cut it all off. And then for a few hours she was comfortable. But the hair went on growing. And now it grew twice as fast as before, so that in 36 days it was as long as ever. Oh, the poor princess cried with tiredness. And when she couldn't bear it anymore, she cut her hair and was comfortable for a little time. The hair now grew 4 times as fast as at first. And in 18 days, it was as long as before, and she had to have it cut. Then it grew 8 inches a day. And the next time it was cut, it grew 16 inches a day, and then 32 inches, and 64 inches, and 128 inches a day, and so on, growing twice as fast after each cutting. The princess would go to bed at night with her hair clipped short and wake up in the morning with yards and yards and yards of golden hair flowing all around the room, so that she could not move without pulling her own hair, and nurse had to come and cut the hair off before she could get out of bed. "I wish I were bald again," sighed poor Melisande, looking at the little green caps she used to wear. And she cried herself to sleep at night because the golden billows of the golden hair. But she never let her mother see her cry, because it was the queen's fault, and Melisande did not want to seem to reproach her. When the princess's hair first grew, her mother sent locks of it to all her royal relations, who had set them in rings and brooches. Later,
the queen was able to send enough for bracelets and girdles, but presently so much hair was cut off that they had to burn it. Then when autumn came and all the crops failed, it seemed as though all the gold of harvest had gone into the princess's hair, and there was a famine. Then Melisande said, "It seems a pity to waste all my hair. It does grow so very fast. Couldn't we stuff things with it or something and sell them to feed the people?" So the king called a council of merchants, and they sent out samples of the princess's hair, and soon orders came pouring in. The princess's hair became the staple export of that country. They stuffed pillows with it, and they stuffed beds with it. They made ropes of it for sailors to use, and curtains for hanging in king's palaces. They made haircloth of it for hermits and other people who wished to be uncomfortable, but because it was so soft and silky, it only made them happy and warm, which they did not wish to be. So the hermits gave up wearing it, and instead, mothers bought it for their little babies, and all well-born infants wore little shirts of princess haircloth. And still the hair grew and grew, and the people were fed, and the famine came to an end. Then the king said, "It was all very well while the famine lasted, but now I shall write to my fairy godmother and see if something cannot be done." So he wrote and sent the letter by a skylark, and by return of bird came this answer: "Why not advertise for a competent prince? Offer the usual reward." So the king sent out his heralds all over the world to proclaim that any respectable prince with proper references would marry the Princess Melisande if he could stop her hair from growing. Then from far and near came trains of princes anxious to try their luck, and with them they brought all sorts of nasty baggage in bottles and round wooden boxes. The princess tried all the remedies, but she did not like any of them, and she did not like any of the princes. So in her heart she was rather glad that none of the nasty things in bottles and boxes made the least difference to her hair. The princess had to sleep in the great throne room now, because no other room was big enough to hold her hair. When she woke in the morning, the long, high room would be quite full of her golden hair, packed tight and thick like wool in a barn. And every night she would sit in her green silk gown by the window and cry and kiss the little green cap she used to wear and wish herself bald again. It was as she sat crying there on Midsummer Eve that she first saw Prince Florizel. He had come to the palace that evening, but he would not appear in her presence with the dust of travel on him, and she had retired with her hair borne by 20 pages before he had bathed and changed his garments and entered the reception room. Now he was walking in the garden in the moonlight. He looked up, and she looked down, and for the first time Melisande, looking on a prince, wished that he might have the power to stop her hair from growing. As for the prince, he wished many things, and the first was granted him, for he said, "You are Melisande, and you are Florizel. There are many roses round your window," he said to her, "and none down here." She threw him one of three white roses she held in her hand. Then he said, "White rose trees are strong. May I climb up to you?"
"Certainly," said the princess.
So he climbed up to the window. "Now," said he, "if I can do what your father asks, will you agree to marry me?"
"My father has promised that I shall," said Melisande, playing with the white roses in her hand.
"Dear princess," said he, "your father's promise is nothing to me. I want yours. Will you give it to me?"
"Yes," said she, and she gave him the second rose.
"I want your hand."
"Yes,"
she said.
"And your heart with it."
"Yes,"
said the princess, and she gave him the third rose. "And a kiss to seal the promise."
"Yes,"
said she. "And a kiss to go with the hand."
"Yes,"
said she.
and a kiss to bring the heart.
Yes, said the princess,
and she gave him the three kisses. Now, said he, when he had given them back to her, tonight, do not go to bed. Stay by your window, and I will stay down here in the garden and watch. And when your hair has grown enough to fill your room, call to me, and then do as I tell you.
I will, said the princess.
So at dewy sunrise, the prince, lying on the turf beside the sundial, heard her voice.
Florizel, Florizel, my hair has grown so long that it is pushing me out of the window.
Get out onto the windowsill, he said, and twist your hair three times around the great iron hook that is there. And she did. Then the prince climbed up the rose bush with his naked sword in his teeth, and he took the princess's hair in his hand about a yard from her head and said, jump! The princess jumped and screamed, for there she was, hanging from the hook by a yard and a half of her bright hair. The prince tightened his grasp on the hair and cut it cleanly with his sword. Then he let her down gently by her hair till her feet were on the grass and jumped down after her. They stayed talking in the garden till all the shadows had crept under their proper trees and the sundial said it was breakfast time. Then they went in to breakfast, and all the court crowded round to wonder and admire, for the princess's hair had not grown. How did you do it? Said the king, shaking Florizel warmly by the hand. The simplest thing in the world, said Florizel modestly. You have always cut the hair off the princess. I just cut the princess off the hair. Said the king, who had a logical mind. And during breakfast, he more than once looked anxiously at his daughter. When they got up from breakfast, the princess rose with the rest. But she rose and rose and rose till it seemed as though there would never be an end of it. The princess was 9 feet high. I feared as much, said the king sadly. I wonder what will be the rate of progression. You see, he said to poor Florizel, when we cut the hair off, it grows. And when we cut the princess off, she grows. I wish you had happened to think of that. The princess went on growing. By dinner time, she was so tall that she had to have her dinner brought out to the garden because she was too large to get indoors. But she was too unhappy to be able to eat anything, and she cried so much that there was quite a pool in the garden, and several pages were nearly drowned. So she remembered her Alice in Wonderland and stopped crying at once. But she did not stop growing. And she grew bigger and bigger and bigger till she had to go outside the palace gardens and sit on the common, and even that was too small to hold her comfortably, for every hour she grew twice as much as she had done the hour before, and nobody knew what to do, nor where the princess was to sleep. But fortunately, her clothes had grown with her, or she would have been very cold indeed. Now she sat on the common in her green gown embroidered with gold, looking like a great hill covered with dandelions. You cannot possibly imagine how large the princess was growing as her mother stood wringing her hands on the castle tower, and Prince Florizel looked on, broken-hearted, to see his princess snatched from his arms and turned into a lady as big as a mountain. The king did not weep or look on. He sat down at once and wrote to his fairy godmother, asking her advice. He sent a weasel with the letter, and by return of weasel, he got his own letter back again marked, gone away, left no address. It was now, when the kingdom was plunged into gloom, that a neighboring king took it into his head to send an invading army against the island where Melisande lived. They came in ships, and they landed in great numbers. And Melisande, looking down from her height, saw alien soldiers marching on the sacred soil of her country. I don't mind so much now, she said, if I can really be of some use this size. And she picked up the army of the enemy in handfuls and double handfuls and put them back into their ships and gave a little flick to each transport ship with her finger and thumb. This sent the ships off so fast that they never stopped till they reached their own country. And when they arrived there, the whole army man to man, said it would rather be court-martialed 100 times over than go near that place again. Meanwhile, Melisande, sitting on the highest hill on the island, felt the land trembling and shivering under her giant feet.
"I do believe I'm getting too heavy," she said,
and jumped off the island into the sea, which was just up to her ankles. Just then a great fleet of warships and gunboats and torpedo boats came in sight on their way to attack the island. Melisande could easily have sunk them all with one kick, but she did not want to do this because it might have drowned the sailors, and besides, it might have swamped the island. So she simply stooped and picked up the island as you would pick up a mushroom, for, of course, all islands are supported by a stalk underneath, and carried it away to another part of the world, so that when the warships got to where the island was marked on the map, they found nothing but sea, and a very rough sea it was, because the princess had churned it all up with her ankles as she walked away through with the island. When Melisande reached a suitable place, very sunny and warm and with no sharks in the water, she set down the island. The people made it fast with anchors, and then everyone went to bed, thanking their kind fate that had sent them so great a princess to help them in their need, and calling her the savior of her country and the bulwark of the nation. But it's poor work being the nation's bulwark and your country's savior when you are miles high, have no one to talk to, and when all you want is to be your humble right size again and to marry your sweetheart. And when it was dark, the princess came close to the island, looked down from far up at her palace and her tower, and cried and cried and cried. Oh, it does not matter how much you cry into the sea, for it hardly makes a difference, however large you may be. Then, when everything was quite dark, the princess looked up at the stars. "I wonder how soon I shall be big enough to knock my head against them," said she. And as she stood stargazing, she heard a whisper right in her ear, a very little whisper, but quite plain. "Cut off your hair," it said. Now, everything the princess was wearing had grown big along with her, so that there now dangled from her golden girdle a pair of scissors as big as the Malay Peninsula, together with a pincushion the size of the Isle of Wight and a tape measure that would have gone around Australia. And when she heard the little voice, she knew it, small as it was, for the dear voice of Prince Florizel. And she whipped out the scissors from her golden case and snip, snip, snipped all her hair off, and it fell into the sea. The coral insects got hold of it at once and set to work on it. Now they have made it into the biggest coral reef in the world, but that has nothing to do with the story. Then the voice said, "Get close to the island." And the princess did, but she could not get very close because she was so large. She looked up again at the stars, and they seemed to be much farther off. Then the voice said, "Be ready to swim." And she felt something climb out of her ear and clamber down her arm. The stars got farther and farther away, and the next moment the princess found herself swimming in the sea and Prince Florizel swimming beside her. "I crept onto your hand when you were carrying the island," he explained, when their feet touched the sand as they walked in through the shallow water. "And I got into your ear with an ear trumpet. You never noticed me because you were so huge."
"Oh, my dear prince," cried Melisande, falling into his arms. "You have saved me. I am my proper size again."
So they went home and told the king and queen. Both were very, very happy. But the king rubbed his chin with his hand and said, "You certainly have some fun for your money, young man, but don't you see that we're just where we were before? Why, the child's hair is growing again already." And indeed it was. Then once more the king sent a letter to his godmother. He sent it by flying fish, and by return of fish came the answer. "Just back from my holidays. Sorry for your troubles. Why not try scales?" And on this message, the whole court pondered for hours. But the prince caused a pair of gold scales to be made and hung them up in the palace gardens under a big oak tree. And the next morning he said to the princess,
My darling Melisande, I really must speak seriously to you. We are getting on in life. I am nearly 20. It is time that we thought of being settled. Will you trust me entirely and get into one of those golden scales? So he took her down into the garden and helped her onto the scale. And she curled up in it in her green and gold gown like a little grass mound with buttercups on it.
And what is going on the other scale? Asked Melisande.
Your hair, said Florizel. You see, when your hair is cut off you, it grows. And when you are cut off your hair, you grow. Oh, my heart's delight, I can never forget how you grew, never. But if, when your hair is no more than you, and you are no more than your hair, I snip the scissors between you and it, then neither you nor your hair can possibly decide which ought to go on growing.
Suppose both did?
Asked the poor princess humbly.
Impossible, said the prince with a shudder. There are limits even to Malevola's malevolence. And besides, Fortuna said scales. Will you try it?
I will do whatever you wish, said the poor princess. But let me kiss my father and my mother once, and nurse, and you too, my dear, in case I grow large again and can kiss nobody any more.
So they came one by one and kissed the princess. Then nurse cut off the princess's hair, and at once it began to grow at a frightful rate. The king and queen and nurse busily packed it as it grew into the other scale, and gradually the scale went down a little. Prince stood waiting between the scales with his drawn sword, and just before the two were equal, he struck. But during the time his sword took to flash through the air, the princess's hair grew a yard or two, so that the instant he struck, the balance was true. You are a young man of sound judgment, said the king, embracing him, while the queen and nurse ran to help the princess out of the gold scale. The scale, full of golden hair, bumped down onto the ground as the princess stepped out of the other one and stood there before those who loved her, laughing and crying with happiness because she remained her proper size. And her hair was not growing any more. She kissed the prince 100 times, and the very next day they were married. Everyone remarked on the beauty of the bride, and it was noticed that her hair was quite short, only 5 feet 5 1/4 inches long, just down to her pretty ankles. This is because the scales had been 10 feet 10 1/2 inches apart, and the prince, having a straight eye, had cut the golden hair exactly in the middle.
Jane Curtin performed E. Nesbitt's Melisande. After a brief break, an earthquake from Barbara Kingsolver. You're listening to selected shorts recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. I'm John Lithgow. For more information about the stories you're hearing, the readers who are reading them, or about the Selected Shorts writing contest, you can go to selectedshorts.org or wnyc.org/shorts. Next, Barbara Kingsolver's narrator is caught up in an earthquake tremor that seems to symbolize the fragility of all things. L.A. Law Star, An Old Friend of Mine. Jill Eikenberry reads. Here's Fault Lines by Barbara Kingsolver.
Randall is moving away from his living wife. With the reckless, innocent grace of a liberated animal, he scrambles, toes and hands, up the face of a huge rock. This must be Africa because none of the trees look right. The two boys are little and hold on to her hands, watching their father. When he straddles the top, Randall turns around to wave at the three of them. She's about to tell him to be careful, but then he jumps off. Just jumps on purpose, as if he means to amuse the boys. It's much too high. His body bounces several times with a dull energy like an old tennis ball. He lies still and then looks up at her sorrowfully because he knows he's going to die. Grace wakes up with her breath quick in her throat. It's exactly 5 a.m. She gets up to check on the boys, who are breathing, as they've been doing steadily for more than a decade and will surely continue to do. She wishes she could believe it. Her new friends in California tell her to trust the universe. But Grace sees nothing trustworthy about the universe. It's full of exploding stars. Randall didn't die in Africa, but in Louisville, 2 miles from home, when a drill bit broke in the machine shop where he worked. His employer called it a freak accident. Grace considers it a freak accident that anyone ever makes it through life in one piece. When the life insurance came through, she thought it would help her mindset to get away from Kentucky, so they moved to Oakland. Now she has earthquakes to consider. She goes back to bed, but sits up against the headboard, waiting for the sun to come up and the boys to stir and another day to happen. The blue shirt she hugs around herself is Randall's, going threadbare at the elbows, wearing out without him. Maybe she dreamt of Randall out of guilt because she's going on her first date tonight. A blind date. The term alone sounds hazardous. A redhead named Fiona in her grieving group is setting Grace up with her brother. Grace would rather pass, but Fiona has that California air of calling everything between here and New York the Midwest. In a pitying way, and organizing your whole life for you over the phone before you know what's hit you. Fiona also likes to brag that her apartment is located exactly on the San Andreas Fault. Grace's relatives have reminded her that Kentucky gets earthquakes too. In 1812, one hit that made the Mississippi run backwards. There's nothing new under the sun to worry about, her cousin Rita declared. Grace is amazed at the things people will say, supposedly to be helpful. When she was pregnant, both times, women would stop her in the grocery to describe their own pregnancies, always disastrous. Don't do what I did, someone actually told her once in Frozen Foods at Kroger's. I went into labor in the 5th month and had a boy that's blind and retarded. He's at the Lexington Shriners home. Grace was exactly 5 months pregnant. With Jacob then, it was Christmas Eve. She went straight home to bed, not daring to carry in the groceries from the car. When Randall got home, the ice cream had melted into a huge puddle in the bottom of the trunk and then refrozen. He tried to make her laugh about it. He called it the Neapolitan skating rink. Randall always trusted the universe, and he ended up with a drill bit in his femoral artery. Grace wipes her eyes on his shirt sleeve. The people in her grief group say she's in the denial phase, but she's not denying anything. She knows he's dead. She just wishes she could go back and start life over. She'd meet Randall again, and they'd move into a safe deposit box. In the parking lot after work, Grace has an attack of despair. Her job is not the cause. It's a position she secured with the help of her former boss before moving here. She's a secretary for a company that sells high-pressure liquid chromatography systems to scientists everywhere. She's not clear on what high-pressure liquid chromatography is, but Karima, the cheeky receptionist who shares the front office, has even less of an idea, and she's been there for over a year. Do I look like a rocket scientist? She asks Grace. She doesn't. She looks like an exotic paintbrush. She wears black tights and has dyed her hair fuchsia on the ends and somehow persuades it to reach for the stars. She gives Grace wardrobe tips and tells her she envies her petite figure and undamaged hair. This is one more concern Grace hasn't much considered before, hair damage. When she confided this afternoon that she had a date after work, Karima offered the loan of her lucky earrings. So Grace has a pair of little silver snakes biting her earlobes now. But she has no idea what good luck would bring her if she came into any. She doesn't want to drive to UC Berkeley and fall in love tonight. She wants to go home and find Randall in the driveway shooting baskets, missing on purpose so Jacob can win a round of horse. Puberty is turning Matthew's face into an exact replica of his father's. He'll never even know what they look like, she thinks. When he died, they still had preteen baby faces, no jawbones, no real noses yet, just stamped out cookie dough faces like all kids have till they've lived long enough to reveal their family secrets. She pulls the car off the street and crumples around the pain in her stomach. She thinks of Randall's face in her dream, so pleased. Before he jumped. Why Africa? Where is he trying to take her? How can she hold back what happens next? She lies curled on the front seat, staring up at the darkening sky and a neon fish blinking its way to no particular reward. People have told her she's taking his death too personally. She wonders what options she has. If she were a plant, she'd take it like a plant. She sits up again, fixes her eyes, and drives. Fiona's brother, Lauren, turns out to be 40-ish and tall, with long black hair and pale blue eyes, and a blue tattoo in Chinese that curls around his wrist like a suicide scar. If you saw this guy on the street, Grace thinks, you'd expect him to ask for a quarter or steal your purse. But now here he is, her date. Parking is a problem, so they leave her car in his reserved space at the university and walk to the restaurant. Grace never knows what to make of Berkeley's cleverness. A stationer's shop called Avant Card. A coffee house called Sufficient Grounds. In the town where I grew up, she confesses, nobody would even get these jokes. It's true. Grace barely remembers what she once expected to find here. Trolley cars, and the ocean. Now she isn't sure whether she's come up in the world or just moved to a city of pretenders. If these people have all the answers, why are they living on a fault line? Also, they're dying like crazy. A great, sad wave of them. Lauren touches her arm, and they both stop to let a blind young man pass by. His sight taken, Grace now understands, by AIDS. She's learned about retinitis and pneumocystis and the other devastations from three different people in her grief group. She often feels she's being introduced to her new home through the tragedy channel. They arrive at their destination, the China Doll. The menu is printed in Chinese with hesitant-looking translations in pencil. Grace laughs at an item called funny-tasting eggplant. Who'd order that? She asks Lauren. It sounds like you'd get salmonella. He smiles. My sister forced you into this, didn't she? No, it's okay. She's trying to help me take charge of my life. She thinks I'm lonely. Are you? Lauren watches her up close. Up close, he's going a little gray and seems more respectable than she'd first thought. No, I've got two boys. Did she tell you? Teenagers in the house are like living in a buffalo herd. His face registers a tiny shock. People here always do that, she's noticed. It's one more backward thing she's done with her life. Had kids before she was 20. I'm envious, he says. My life is too quiet. Nothing ever happens. Maybe one of my books might fall off the shelf. Grace doesn't believe for a minute that this man's life is too quiet. It dawns on her that the envies people claim on her, undamaged hair, rowdy teenagers, are stretching it. They're being nice to a widow from East Jesus Nowhere. She looks around the restaurant and wonders if everybody has already guessed this is a first date going on here. She and Lauren are both practically glowing with miserable goodwill. What kind of What are you at the university, she asks. Fiona said, an associate professor of Chinese history, he says, and her eyes inadvertently go to the tattoo on his wrist. He looks down, too, then draws up his sleeve and displays it for her. It says, beware of funny-tasting eggplant. Grace laughs, feeling grateful. Even if she never sees him again, she'll remember that he helped her get through this day. So can you read this whole menu, she asks. They're interrupted by a peppy blonde waiter wearing checked pants and a moppy haircut, something like Dennis the Menace. Can I answer any questions for you tonight, he asks. Sure, says Lauren. What is the meaning of life? Enjoy it. You don't die with your assets, you die with your memories. Grace is amazed. She doesn't think she'll ever be witty enough to live here. When the waiter is gone, she asks, what does it really say, your tattoo? I'll bet it's some girl. Worse than that, it's a quote from the I Ching that I considered momentous when I was 17. You don't die with your assets, you die with your memories? Something along those lines. Never get a tattoo. The waiter brings their wine and they stare into their glasses. They both glance up as the blind man who passed them earlier comes into the restaurant with a companion and is seated at a far table. Everything that happens to you is like a tattoo, Grace says quietly. It might not show on the outside, but it's permanent. Or it shows up later, Lauren says. Grace wonders if he's thinking of AIDS. You know what I keep imagining? Whenever I come over here to Berkeley, I see all these guys blinded in wheelchairs, and I think they're home from some war that nobody knows about. Everybody knows about it. They just wish they didn't. No, I don't think so. There are lots of little towns like the one I grew up in where they're still in the dark. They haven't heard? Oh, they've heard. But they scrub behind their ears and go to church and count on being saved. My cousin told me somebody I used to know was back there visiting his mother and went swimming in the country club pool. After he'd left, the city council found out he was HIV positive. They revoked his mother's membership and drained the swimming pool. Lauren appears to choke or laugh. Drained the pool? Yes, can you imagine? They don't have any idea of how big a disaster it is. I guess they figure they had a near miss, but it's all under control now. People don't believe in disasters. I do, Grace vows. No, I mean real Cecil B. DeMille natural disasters, epidemics and floods and locust plagues. People believe in individual will. They think they can control what happens to them. Drain the pool. Hell, drain the ocean. Uncontrollable pestilence and boils are things that happened a million years ago to Moses, not to people who possess microchip technology. Right. Here's to pestilence and boils, Grace says, raising her glass. She's aware that this may be the unsexiest conversation in the history of dating. Matthew is asleep when she gets home, but Jacob is still up working on an experiment with goldfish that he's conducting for a science fair. Grace is amazed at the difference between Kentucky and California school systems. Last year, Jacob pasted photos of endangered species on a poster and won first prize. This year, he's worked every night for weeks to make something Grace thinks ought to go on NOVA, and he says it's terrible. A lot of kids have better projects. It stuns her to realize that she's brought her sons to a place where they'll grow up feeling second rate, as she does. So many things in life she has failed to predict. Jacob's experiment involves electricity, but he swears it doesn't hurt the goldfish. Grace believes it because he's named them Madonna and Goldilocks. Jacob has the softest heart of any 14-year-old she's ever heard of. He's been obsessed with endangered species all his life. Jacob believes in disasters. Grace knows. Adults walk around making jokes about the hole in the ozone. Even Johnny Carson does. But Jacob looks up at the sky and chews the skin around his cuticles. They do this in Germany to test the drinking water, he explained to her on the day he brought home the fish in a box of electrodes. They keep all these goldfish in a tank of city water downtown, and they monitor the current. The fish give off so many electrical impulses per minute when the water's pure. If there's too much zinc or cadmium or stuff like that in it, then they give off less. It makes a power shortage, and that sets off an alarm at the headquarters. Jacob's experiment only shows the electrical emissions from happy fish. His teacher told him that he would need to show both control and polluted conditions for a chance at the prize, but Jacob said no. His room is papered with endangered cheetahs and great dying whales. He's not going to poison Madonna and Goldilocks with zinc. On Saturday morning, Grace feels an unsteadiness in her kitchen. She suspects of being a tremor. 2 minutes later, the phone rings, and she's pretty sure it will be Fiona telling her to go stand under a doorway. It's Fiona, all right, but she just wants a report on the date. Grace runs down the details, including the menu of the China doll. There's not a lot more to tell. No electricity, Fiona concludes, and Grace laughs, thinking of Jacob's goldfish. Maybe we're swimming through too much pollution, she thinks, and then on impulse decides to tell Fiona about her dream. Your brother's sweet, but I'm still too attached to Randall to see another man, she says, describing how her heart was pounding, how she woke up feeling guilty. He bounced when he fell? That sounds almost whimsical. It wasn't whimsical, Grace says, shocked. It was awful. He looked down at us and then he just jumped on purpose. Sounds like you're holding him responsible for his death, Fiona says. Fiona has been through so much therapy, she feels qualified to say things that normal people would consider extremely none of their business. She and her husband got a no-fault divorce and lived for 1 year as best friends before he died of a drug overdose. But this grief group is only the latest of a long series of groups for Fiona. I don't hold him responsible, Grace says. It was an industrial accident. I blame OSHA. But you blame him for being there. You've told me yourself you wished he'd finished his night courses and been a CPA. Grace regrets bringing up the dream. She knows Fiona could be partly right. I just feel abandoned sometimes. Not that it's his fault, just mad that we got left behind. It's natural to want to blame somebody. I know. Your brother said people don't believe in disasters, they believe in individual will. Oh, Fiona laughs. Lauren's a little intense. But it's true. It's the modern age, Grace. We all act like we were born with some certificate saying we're going to have perfect, happy lives guaranteed. So if you slip on a bar of soap, you sue Procter & Gamble. I saw a show about that on Oprah, Grace says, hoping to change the subject. This woman got a window cleaner in her eye and went blind. She sued the window cleaner company, and then she turned around and sued her maid for taking the day off. It's a totally American phenomenon, Fiona says. We refuse to accept bad luck. After work on Monday, Grace drives into San Francisco to pick up Jacob from the science fair. Matthew will come home on the bus alone and log in a few more hours as a latchkey child. He's 13 and seems tough beyond his years, with his spiked haircut and high-topped sneakers. But Grace still worries. Mom, I think there's going to be an earthquake today, Jacob reports from the back seat as they're transporting Goldilocks and Madonna home. They won third prize. Why is that? Grace asks, not doubting it a bit. All the experiments with white rats messed up today. They wouldn't go through the mazes or anything. They just all huddled up together in their boxes. It was lucky for me. That's the only reason I won a prize. You think white rats know when an earthquake's coming? All mammals do, except people. They can smell the positive ions that get released into the air. If that's so, Grace says, they ought to have a big cage of rats downtown at the fire station like your German goldfish. They do have rats downtown, Jacob says, but nobody's keeping an eye on them. Grace smiles. She believes Jacob is a near genius, something she always felt about Randall, too, even though he worked in an auto plant. He didn't want to be a CPA. He wanted to make cars. He just had his own crazy way of looking at the world. So how come we can't smell the positive ions like other animals do? I don't know, he says. And Grace can tell he's looking out the window thinking about this. They're approaching the eastbound on-ramp to the Bay Bridge. The double-decker traffic makes her nervous, with all those westbound commuters whizzing by above them. But both boys love crossing the water. She tries to relax and see the bridge as they do, an intricate forest of I-beams. Finally, he says, I guess we're tracking so many other stimuli that we don't notice the positive ions. We're too busy doing our own stuff. Isn't that the truth, Grace thinks. And then suddenly her car is out of control. Oh, God, she says. Oh, my God, I've got a flat tire. I've got two flat tires. She pulls as hard as she can on the steering wheel, and the car sways less and less violently and finally comes to a stop, as far over to the right as she can get on the cramped bridge. She jumps out and looks under the car. She can't see a thing wrong with the tires on this side. She walks around to the other side and then sees Jacob getting out of the car laughing. He points behind Grace and she turns around. 100 other cars are pulling over, 100 other drivers all bent over staring at their tires. It's taking everybody quite a while to realize that this isn't a personal problem. She finds the scene hilarious. She thinks again of Randall catching her eye, spreading his arms wide to embrace the air. It is whimsical. Nobody knows what's going to happen next. That's where he's trying to take her, that far and no farther. There are only two choices in the what happens next department: to pretend it's your job to know, or admit you don't have a clue. The steel cables over Grace's head hum strangely and then suddenly go slack. Somewhere the structure has broken. Lots of drivers have raised their hoods and are waiting for a tow truck, civilized salvation, hoping they still might make their appointments. For once, Grace feels like the only person around who's getting the joke. It will be hours, if not tomorrow, before they're all off this bridge. "Forget it," she says aloud. "Nobody's coming. This is the mess we're in." The concrete is still trembling under her shoes, and Grace laughs so hard she can't stop. There are stalled cars over her head and the dancing bay below, and Jacob is hugging her. She decides to trust the universe.
Jill Eikenberry read Barbara Kingsolver's Fault Lines. Barbara Kingsolver's most recent novel is Flight Behavior. I'm John Lithgow. Thank you for joining me on Selected Shorts. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and was directed by Isaiah Sheffer. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Jim Briggs III. Our guest commentator is Hannah Tinti. Our programs presented at the Getty Center in Los Angeles are recorded by Phil Richards. Our theme music is David Peterson's That's the Deal, performed by the Deerdorf Peterson Group. Major support for Selected Shorts has been provided by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2012 by Tom Parada. Additional support has been provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the Henry Nias Foundation, the New York Community Trust's Program for Performing Arts Groups, Seedlings Foundation, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts has also been supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and with public funds from the New York State Council on the Arts. Selected Shorts is brought to you in part by Zabars.com, delivering New York original toasting bagels, coffee, smoked salmon, babka, and more throughout the 50 states, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. More information at Zabars.com/shorts. Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and from the PRI Program Fund. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI Public Radio International.
PRI Public Radio International.